This is an interview with Lieutenant William Driscoll, United States Navy, Naval Flight Officer and Radar Intercept Officer, RIO, in the Vietnam War. He shares the honor with Lieutenant Randall Cunningham, who was his pilot, of being the first all-missile ace with a total of 5 MiG kills to their credit. Lieutenant Driscoll was born in Boston and attended Stonehill College, where he earned a bachelor's degree in economics. In college, he was captain of the baseball team, sports editor of the school newspaper and yearbook, and a member of the dean's list. He joined the United States Navy in April 1969, was commissioned an ensign on 15 August 1969, and earned his Wings of Gold on 10 May 1970. On 1 October 1971, he sailed on his first combat cruise to Vietnam as a member of Fighter Squadron 96, on board USS Constellation. He was selected by Lieutenant Cunningham to be his Radar Intercept Officer, RIO, and as such, on 19 January 1972, he shared in 1 MiG 21 kill, and on 8 May 1972, 1 MiG 17 kill. On 10 May 1972, Lieutenant Driscoll and Lieutenant Cunningham shot down 3 MiGs, including North Vietnam's leading ace, Colonel Toon, who had 13 American kills to his credit. For this action, Lieutenant Driscoll and Lieutenant Cunningham were nominated for the Medal of Honor. This interview is being conducted at the Naval Air Station Miramar, San Diego, California, on 14 March 1974. The interviewer is Captain R.A. Bowling, United States Navy retired, graduate student at San Diego State University.
All right, Lieutenant Driscoll, if you would please, would you start off a little bit of your personal background?
Certainly. I'm from back on the East Coast, the Boston area. I went to college at a place called Stonehill College in northeastern Massachusetts, where I majored in economics. I participated in varsity baseball, where I was captain of the baseball team, sports editor of the school newspaper and school yearbook, and member of the dean's list. After graduation, I furthered my education by driving a Budweiser beer truck for 8 months in the Boston area. And I became interested in naval aviation when I first found that the Navy did things besides drive ships around in the water. And I was told that only the elite and the most highly competent of people are able to consistently land on a carrier deck, particularly at night, and come back and do it the next night. The expertise involved there was of the highest caliber. I was told, however, that it was nearly impossible to get into that program, at which time I immediately became interested. And after taking my qualifying test...
Excuse me, did you say you found out that it was impossible to
Nearly get? Impossible. In other words, only, as they put it, the cream of the crop of those eligible were selected.
This sharpened your desire to get in rather than turning you off, is what you're saying.
Yes.
All right.
So what I did was buy a book on aerodynamics and on flying airplanes just to familiarize myself with some of the basic terminology. Took the qualifying test, passed by one grade point, and then went through the personal two-day physical, the interviews, etc., submitted the application, and found out 5 months later that I was accepted for the flight program. At that time, of course, the Navy is very strict with their requirements for aviators, and they require perfect 20/20 vision, which mine was. However, my depth perception was not exactly within limits. Therefore, I was told that I could enter the Naval Flight Officer Program, but not the pilot program.
And so you are what they call NFO.
NFO is the correct terminology, Naval Flight Officer. Therefore, I went to NAS Pensacola to start flight training 9 April 1969. I completed what they call Aviation Officer Candidate School, 18-week school with emphasis on physical education, survival swimming, where you had to swim a mile with flight gear and stay afloat for 15 minutes in your flight gear with nothing, just treading water, where you had to swim side stroke, back stroke, breast stroke, 50 yards of each simultaneously, where they put you in an airplane cockpit, strapped you in, and you went down. They call it a Dilbert Dunker, and thing went upside down, and you had to unstrap yourself, I said calmly in quotes, and get out of the cockpit. At any rate, I was commissioned an ensign in the United States Naval Reserve, 15 August 69, at which time I now commenced with basic flight training at Training Squadron Number 10 at Pensacola for the next 14 weeks, with heavy emphasis on navigation, radar, electronics, weather, computer analysis, things of this nature, general background information. I was always interested in being accepted for jet aircraft, and most particularly in the F-4 Phantom fighter. Always wanted to build fighters. However, who went where was determined only by grades and class standing, and as you can imagine, only the top students would be chosen for the fighter or the jet aircraft. As for instance, in my class of 36, there were five men chosen for jets. Of that five men, three were chosen for fighters, and of the three chosen, there was only one chosen for fighters on the West Coast, which was myself, and two were chosen for fighters, or more specifically, F-4 Phantoms on the East Coast. After completing Training Squadron 10 at NAS Pensacola, I went to RIO school at NAS Glencoe, Georgia, where for the next 4 months I learned the basics of what it would require of me to be a competent fleet RIO, flying in the backseat of an F-4 Phantom. At the completion of this program, I was awarded my Wings of Gold and given orders to Training Squadron out in California, VF-121, where I would learn how to fly and fight the F-4 Phantom. I checked aboard NAS Miramar in June of 1970, completing the prescribed F-4 training in August of 1971. The long backlog at that time was due to the fact that action in Southeast Asia was quiet, and there were numerous pools with backlogs of students at that time, and thus explaining the backlog.
What was that date again, Lieutenant?
I received my Wings of Gold in Georgia May 10, 1970. June of 1970, I commenced with F-4 training out at NAS Miramar in San Diego, California. I completed the training in August of 71. I received orders to VF-96, which was deploying aboard USS Constellation and leaving NAS North Island, San Diego, 1 October 71. On a combat cruise to Western Pacific. At that time, of course, there was numerous people in the area protesting the departure of Constellation into the war zone. As a matter of fact, Jane Fonda and Joan Baez were in town, and they had been conducting rallies with their emphasis on keep the county home. And of course, they were pointing out the nature of the war machine, the cost of the machine in terms of running the war each day. This, for me personally, had no effect on. I believed in exactly what I was doing. It had no personal effect on any of my beliefs or exactly what I was doing. I was fully trained and ready to go.
What, what impact did this movement, anti-war movement, have, say, overall on, first, just the pilots?
It had no effect on any of the members of my peer group. We didn't, to use a cliche, bat an eyelash. It was the only effect that it had was security was more intense in NAS North Island, so we had a little bit more trouble getting on the base to get on the carrier. That was the only effect.
What impact did it have, say, on the non-flying elements in the squadron?
It's difficult for me to comment on their feelings. The maintenance people in my squadron, who I came into contact with on a daily basis, displayed to me no noticeable effect of these events transpiring in the area.
What about the enlisted men?
Yes, that's what I'm referring to.
Okay. No.
And what I was able to observe, no known effect. And nonetheless, whenever there would be one person in the group that would display a reaction to a situation like that, he would be dramatized as indicative of the group's reaction, which in my experience was not the case.
Now, what do you mean? If one took an anti-war...
A dissenting or an anti-war position...
And that was taken...
In some cases, the media would display the tendency to display this as indicative of the group's feeling, when in point of fact, it was a very small minority feeling.
Now, when you say very small minority, roughly, how many men were in the squad?
In my squadron, there were 35 officers and approximately 80 to 100 enlisted types.
And to your knowledge, how many of them actually actively participated in an anti-war?
I have no knowledge of anyone participating, nor have I even heard of anyone talking about participating.
But what about the small minority?
I'm talking of in terms of the 5,000 men on board the ship. And when I say small minority, I heard a story once of one or two men that were held up in a church that weren't going to go on board the Constellation. And that's one or two men out of 5,000, therefore small minority.
Now, they flew those people back to the Carnegie, as you probably remember. What was the reception, or what was the impact when these men, essentially AWOLs, they missed movement intentionally, what was the impact on the crew?
I don't know, I was sleeping when they got back. No, more seriously, I don't feel that there was any significant impact or any significant reaction. I know by fellow aviators, except that, well, geez, it's too bad those guys are in jail now. And we said it rather snidely, but there was no personal deep feeling one way or the other. We were going to sea, we were getting ready for a combat cruise, and that's what our feeling and our thinking was directed toward. It had, in my personal experience, this had no effect.
What you call professionalism?
Well, probably professionalism slash unemotional reaction to, in our opinion, a rather trite, isolated instance.
Okay, now, can we go on to the non-political, if you will?
Certainly.
But if at any time these pressures were, this situation changed, please throw it in. Sorry, go ahead.
Therefore, we disembarked from NAS North Island on our combat cruise. We reached the Philippine Islands, at which time we were loaded up with our combat ordnance loads and prepared for detaching to the Gulf of Tonkin to commence with special operations on Yankee Station. The first several months of the war, or our participation in the war in Southeast Asia, were involved with us working in the Laotian area, working against interdiction points along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. At that time, it was the dry season, and the enemy was attempting to relocate supplies, open up roads, areas of communication, areas of transportation, and bringing his supplies southward from North Vietnam.
Time frame?
Time frame, November, December 1971, the dry season. And this work occurred exclusively in Laos. We worked with the Air Force in terms of their small propeller-driven airplanes would be forward air controllers. We would check in with them. We would talk on two-way frequency. The Air Force forward air controller, or FAC as we call them, would roll in, drop a smoke bomb, and mark the area where he wanted us to put our bombs. And then we, in turn, would roll in with our bombs into that area. And you may ask, well, what type of area was it? I was never in anything or any area other than what appeared to me to be totally unpopulated, large, entangled jungle. Nothing more than military targets, and you asked me to be more specific, and I never saw anything more specific than an area of smoke below where I was directed to put the bombs. That's as specific as I can be.
What type of aircraft were you flying at this time?
I was flying the F-4J
Phantom. And it was being used primarily in this case as a bomber?
Yes, as a bomber in this case.
But its official designation is fighter bomber.
Fighter.
Not fighter bomber.
Well, it received the word bomber because it was used more as a bomber in some cases than it was as a fighter. It is the Navy's presently, well, the F-14 is replacing that, but it was the Navy's premier fighter aircraft.
How much of a load could you carry?
We carried 6 500-pound bombs and 6 air-to-air missiles.
Can you say what kind they were?
Yes, we carried 4 of the heat seeker missiles and 2 of the radar guided missiles. Now, in the course of our operation, the fire from the ground that the enemy would put up or his resistance against us was almost negligible. And I personally did not see any significant fire from the ground or resistance from the enemy until I had my opportunity to go into North Vietnam for the first time. I saw on this occasion my first encounters with Soviet-built surface-to-air missiles. And as a matter of fact, one of the airplanes in my section was shot down by one.
On your first incursion,
First incursion into North Vietnam. Yes. And this operation occurred late December 1971. For several days, we flew into...
excuse me, Lieutenant. Would you mind going back to that first, your personal first encounter with a missile anti-aircraft type of...
The weather was bad, and by that I mean that below us there was a heavy cloud cover. The missile is white, and the smoke trail of the missile is white, and the whole key to flying against one and beating it was, first of all, being able to see it. Now, we have equipment in the airplane to warn us that the enemy is about to shoot a missile, and that he has just fired a missile through radar equipment that warns us of these things. However, you cannot beat or defeat something that you cannot see. We must, and in all cases, the pilots must visually acquire these missiles when they are airborne, guiding on our airplanes, if they are to beat them. If they do not visually acquire them, they cannot beat them. And if this missile goes off, it does not have to hit the airplane. If it goes off within a certain proximity of where I am, from where I am, it will knock my airplane down. And thus was the case in the instance of the man I referred to recently, who had been shot down by the missile. Now, in my particular case, the anti-aircraft fire was so heavy that we had to drop our bombs prior to reaching the target to get that excess weight off the airplane so that we could just turn and literally fly through the sky for our lives. The anti-aircraft fire, through missiles and through anti-aircraft guns, was that heavy.
How many missiles did you see?
Did I personally see during the whole event? I saw personally in excess of 50.
50?
Yes. Not on this particular day, in the course of my entire experience.
On this particular day,
I saw perhaps 6 to 8.
And what was, on the debrief, if you can, what was the evaluated total number that was fired at that flight that day?
Well, at my flight, I believe they estimated 8 to 10 were fired. However, as special operations did work on Yankee Station, one flight of the wind followed 5 minutes later by another flight, and in other words, the next flight was the 8 to 10. By the end of the day, fortunately, those guys wouldn't see too many because there weren't many left in San Paulo.
Very good.
Now, after this occurred, we did not go back to North Vietnam during the first 2 weeks of January. Again, I was out there, not, again, deciding tactically what would be done, but doing what was decided to be tactically done in the person of our admirals and captains and people who, in my opinion, had a much better grasp of the entire intelligence situation and the impact of what we would do from a political/intelligence standpoint, and most importantly, from a tactical standpoint. And I certainly was most content, number one, to fly my missions and complete them to the best of my ability, and of course, number two, realizing that they had much more information at their disposal than I did. Therefore, realizing that, I never once questioned or even had the remotest doubt as to where I was going and why I was doing what I was doing. Yeah. Therefore...
Did any doubt ever creep in? Did you detect it in, say, the squadron as a whole?
Well, we at times felt perhaps that we were flying into an area where we did not belong, and by that, the weather was below our minimums. You should not fly into areas where with reasonably bad weather or at night when the weather is bad, these hostile SAM environment areas. That's our opinion because we cannot be as successful, number one, hitting our targets, number two, fighting against the SAM missiles, and as you pointed out, number three, seeing the missile ahead of time. I must see the missile a minimum of 5 to 6 seconds before it gets to me in order to beat it. If not, I see it 3 seconds or 2 seconds, it's probably too late.
Can you say how you beat it after you see it?
Yes, I have to turn hard into the missile. I call it a hard high G turn into the missile. By G, it's relative gravitational force, hard into the missile to cause the overshoot, make it missile overshoot.
Can these things reattack?
No,
or is it a one time only.
My feeling, and I say this after having fought against 10 to 12 personally guided on me and having seen 50, they are easy to beat. However, you must see the missile before you can beat it. They are easy to beat once you see the missile.
Very good.
gets rather unpleasant when there are four, five, six coming at the same time from different areas. Activity, again, was reasonably quiet during the first 2 weeks of January, and then we went back into North Vietnam area in the vicinity of Quang Lang Airfield on 19 January 72 to escort a photo airplane who was on a fact-finding intelligence mission. In other words, we knew that the enemy had been building up supplies. We wanted to find out exactly what he had done and where it was located. At this time, we encountered 16 to 18 surface-to-air missiles at varying positions from where we were, and heavy anti-aircraft fire from the ground. Coming out of one of these SAM breaks, surface-to-air missile breaks, myself and my pilot noticed a flight of two MiG-21s on our nose, 2 miles in front of us, down about 100 feet off the ground. We immediately...
What altitude were you at?
We were passing through 2,000 feet, just starting to pull the nose up level with the horizon. We continued our descent, leveled at approximately 300 feet behind the aircraft, chased them up a valley, got down at sometimes to 50 feet, going almost Mach 1, chasing the enemy aircraft.
What airspeed would that be, Lieutenant?
Mach 1 would be somewhere in excess of 600 miles per hour. I, as the RIO, was able to lock one of the enemy aircraft up on my radar. We attempted to fire a radar-guided missile, but there was a missile system failure and we could not fire the radar-guided missile. We therefore fired one of the heat-seeker missiles. However, the enemy aircraft saw the missile coming off my airplane and he broke hard, defeating the missile's tracking solution. However, he reversed back in front of me. We fired a second heat-seeking missile. It went up the enemy's tailpipe and caused his airplane to explode into a large ball of fire. And he rolled over and crashed into the side of a mountain with the flames rolling down to the edge of a small village. We pursued the second airplane. However, our fuel situation was almost critical, and we had to, at this time, turn away and head back out into Laos, where a tanker was waiting for us. We, of course, were very concerned with having to fight more SAMs on the way out. We did not have the fuel to come back out and have to do and execute high G turns, fight the SAMs, and get back into Laos. Fortunately, the enemy did not shoot at us on the way out. And we were able, with minimum fuel, to get to a tanker and get safely back to the carrier. After this occurred, we were awarded the Silver Star by Admiral Zumwalt, who personally came out to Constellation to give us this award. This, of course, was the first MiG kill that the Navy had achieved in almost 22 months. After that time, we flew in support of South Vietnamese forces who were receiving tremendous pressure from the enemy during the early April invasion of the An Loc area. I'm sure you remember at that time when the North Vietnamese flagrantly and brutally attempted to invade the country of South Vietnam below the demilitarized zone, overran Quang Tri City, threatened to overrun Da Nang, and again threatened even Saigon, well to the south, by that 350 miles to the south of the demilitarized zone. At this time,
This is the Easter 72 invasion,
yes. My carrier was in Japan on Liberty, scheduled to return to the United States at the time. We were called back, as we call it now, the Southern Station or Dixie Station. We were called back out to sea and back into combat, and flew in support of the South Vietnamese.
What was the overall reaction to that recall? For one, did you know that a big invasion or a push had started?
Yes, we heard it on the news, and we sat there with fingers crossed, wondering if perhaps we would become re-involved in the conflict. Not because we were for or against the conflict, but more specifically because we felt we'd done our fair share for the last 8 months flying combat.
You've been out there 8 months at that time?
Six months flying combat. We felt at that time, as you can well imagine, that and certainly we were all anxious to return home to our families, friends, and a good life in the United States. Nonetheless, we were called back. We flew in support of the South Vietnamese, and it was at a time, I believe, in late April that the decision was made that because the North Vietnamese were pursuing such an aggressive program and such a flagrantly obvious attempt to invade the country of South Vietnam, the decision was made that we were going to counterattack the enemy from the air. My carrier was then called up to the northern portion of Yankee Station, and we commenced with special operations, flying on a daily basis, what we call alpha strikes. And an alpha strike is composed of anywhere from 18 to 25 to 30 aircraft, all loaded with a minimum of 6 500-pound bombs, and the bomber aircraft loaded with anywhere from 12 to 18 500-pound bombs.
What is a bomber aircraft?
That would be like an A-6 or an A-7 aircraft. We also flew at this time at night in support of the B-52s, who now, and for the first time since I've been involved with operations in Southeast Asia, we were all going right into the heartland, into the nerve center of North Vietnam, into the areas of Hanoi, Haiphong, Bai Thong areas, and the Vin areas. And our specific mission at that time, again, was related to incapacitating military-related targets only. There was never, in all the bombing missions and support missions that I participated in, there never was any attempt to bomb or to fly into or damage anything other than a military-related, and by that I mean an oil storage dump area, a driver truck storage area, a surface-to-air missile site, things of this nature, enemy airfields, military-related targets only. As a matter of fact, the Navy was so strict on where we could go and could not go that we were forced to take a test memorizing specifically the areas where we could and could not fly from a map in North Vietnam so that we would be that well-versed in where we could and could not go. It was that strict. During this time, as you can imagine, the threat from the surface-to-air environment was most intense. Now, there was much publication in the newspapers at that time concerning the bombing of the dikes. This is interesting because the surface-to-air missile sites were located on dikes, and they were shooting at us. And yet, we tried to avoid the missiles with excess weight now on our airplanes in terms of bombs, would let our bombs go in an attempt to save our own lives. Again, if bombs hit dikes, in almost every case it was accidental, if in point of fact it ever did happen. In some cases, and the enemy knew this, and he knew the certainly advantageous propaganda he could derive from this, he therefore located deliberately his surface-to-air missile sites and his artillery sites on the dike areas themselves to shoot at us. This was seldom, if ever, publicized. What was publicized was that American aviation was bombing the dikes. In conjunction with this, the President ordered the mining of Haiphong Harbor, which certainly, in my opinion, after seeing on a daily basis ships from China and the Soviet Union sailing into Haiphong Harbor, loaded with surface-to-air missiles, loaded with MiG aircraft, loaded with trucks. Now, with the mining and when it occurred, these trucks stopped dead in the water out anywhere from 30 to 45 miles from the mouth of Haiphong Harbor. What this meant to me as an aviator was, in time, there would be fewer surface-to-air missiles fired because of the mining operation. There would be fewer MiG aircraft flying, trying to shoot me and my friends down, and hopefully there would be perhaps a quicker ending to this conflict because of the mining of the harbor and the isolating of that country from its totally dependent war effort from what was exported from the Soviet Union and from China, totally dependent on exterior sources for its war effort. Now,
In that, Lieutenant, Did you ever fly any of the missions up along the Chinese border? I mean, do you have any feel for how much was coming in from that direction?
Yes, we know that there were numerous underground oil pipelines coming in directly from China.